On today's program, my special guest is Lama Sultram Aliana, talking about her newest book, Wisdom Rising, A Journey from the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. And I'll play an encore segment of my very first interview with spiritual teacher Neil Donald Walsh. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversations begin now. Hey, welcome to the program. I've really enjoyed this new book, Wisdom Rising, and in describing what it's about, I'd like to share two quotes from some individuals who have signed off on this great work. First, from Eve Ensler, playwright and author of The Vagina Monologues. She writes, "Wisdom Rising is a stunning call to women to trust our bodies and beings, to manifest the energy, vision, and spirit to heal and transform these terrible times. A book full of wisdom, experience, stories, dakinis, mandalas, practices, and possibility." And then the great Ram Dass writes, "Wisdom Rising is a fascinating insight into the divine feminine. This book made me realize how undervalued the feminine perception has been and how women can contribute their uniqueness substantially more than they currently are to the institutions of the culture." Well, the author is with me today. It's Lama Sultram Aliana. She's founder and resident Lama of Tara Mandala, located outside of Boulder, Colorado. She traveled to India in her late teens and at the age of 22 was the first Western woman to be ordained as a Buddhist nun. After living in the Himalayan region for several years, she returned her vows and became the mother of three, while continuing to study and practice Buddhism. She's been awarded the International Outstanding Woman in Buddhism by a panel of distinguished scholars and practitioners in Bangkok, Thailand. It's a joy to have her on today's program, and she's joining us from New York City. Lama Sultram Aliana, it's such an honor and joy to have you on today's program.
Thank you.
I really, really enjoy this book. And to get started, I wanted to share a quote. Actually, it's a quote on the first page of your introduction. It was from Sherry Ruth Anderson and Patricia Hopkins, and they said, "If there is one thing we know from history, it is that patriarchal models of the spiritual have not been kind to women, consciously or unconsciously. The constructs that begin with spirit as the highest and descend to matter as the lowest have traditionally relegated women and nature to the bottom of the scale." Let's talk about this great book you just wrote and how it's relevant to our world right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is the beginning of the book, and it's the opening idea is that historically the fate of women and the fate of nature have been parallel. If we look even in our current situation now, what's happening ecologically and what's happening with women, we can see that parallel. And the spiritual values that are behind that are, as it says in that quote, the idea that spirit or the spiritual ideal is transcendent rather than immanent, immanent meaning in the body. And women and nature have been relegated to the non-spiritual because it's not transcendent. In fact, the word matter derives from the Latin mater, which means mother, sort of like Mother Earth. And so the religious ideals, really in all world religions, have this split between the transcendent ideal and then the human being. And the human being is trying to create a relation with or become one with this higher power or this transcendent force. And so what's happened because of that sociologically is that women and nature have been used and abused. And so we're changing that. It's changing. It's moving, which is, to me, extremely exciting. And we're seeing the women's marches that happened after the inauguration and also the Me Too movement and Time Is Up and so on, where there's a real upswing in terms of the energy that women are feeling and standing up and saying no or saying yes. And so my book is about really how do we empower, empower ourselves in this moment so that we have an inner resource to draw on as this change takes place.
Yeah, when you mentioned that you can see a correspondence between the violence against women and the violence against the earth, mm-hmm. you give statistics. We don't have to go over those stats right now in this interview, but they're in your introduction. And I read those, and I found it alarming. It's like, it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately it does.
And it also then, if we are in such a steep patriarchal system, which clearly we are here in the United States, it affects the laws we enact. It affects the laws we unfortunately mm-hmm. strike off the books, which I see happening constantly from our current president.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there is that great need. I remember David Corton talking about that many years ago in his book, The Great Turning, and also Nobel Peace Laureate Betty Williams, who won a peace prize in Ireland, I think in the 70s. And she was even saying, you know, you're really not going to have more peace in the world until women rise up in leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that also.
Yeah. But
need more women in governance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I distinguish in the book is that it's not merely being in a female body. It's
yes.
a woman who's identified with the qualities of the feminine and not just trying to be like a man. And equal to a man. And of course, equality is very important, but I feel it's very important to develop the full potency of the feminine and bring that to the table.
Yes.
And that's difficult because it's been lost and hidden and repressed for so long. Do we even know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
And so Wisdom Rising is in part discovering what those qualities are in the feminine, and particularly the fierce feminine, mm-hmm. which we need now.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing more of the divine feminine rise up in men these days?
I think that there's a simultaneous awakening into this mm-hmm. aspect of the importance of the feminine, and we have a lot of allies, a lot of male allies who are supporting this. And also men have a feminine part, too. They have a feminine aspect, just as women have a masculine aspect as well. So they're developing that and helping to hold women as they move forward as their allies.
Yeah. What do you think is hindering the divine feminine rising to the level it really, truly needs to be in this world, not only in just this country, but in this world?
Patriarchal religions.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about the divine, women themselves also, even just in terms of their social rights and so on, are controlled to a great extent by patriarchal religions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the values that are presented and the idealization of the masculine and so on in world religions is a major problem
mm-hmm.
in terms of our safety on Earth.
Yeah, I would so agree. And we need to somehow foster that, not only within women, but also within men. And model that. I mean, your book clearly, mm-hmm. it was very well written, is a new voice on the scene to encourage people to do that. I want to take a step back, though, because here you are, the first American woman to be ordained a Lama, Tibetan Buddhist nun, and yet you traveled to India. Let me rephrase that. You had a desire to travel to India in your teens. Most of the teens I know have a desire to go to the next rock concert. So can you share a little bit about the journey back then and how it unfolded into who and what you're about today?
Yes, and let me just make a distinction in terms of some of the things you said. I was first a nun, and then much later became a lama.
Uh-huh.
So a lama is a Buddhist teacher, a guru, you could say. A nun is a monastic. So I went to Nepal very early, at the age of 19, with my friend from college, and I met the Tibetan people who who had very recently come out of China from Tibet because of the Chinese invasion into Tibet that I think most people are aware of because of the Dalai Lama. And so they had been out of Tibet at that point less than 10 years. It was a very fresh quality of their trauma, which every single one of them had some kind of trauma that they'd experienced. And yet they had this amazing joy, sort of joie de vivre. And I couldn't put the two things together. How can they have lost everything and seen atrocities with their own eyes, and yet they seem so happy and peaceful? And that was my sort of awakening to Buddhism. It was really not through books, not through learning. It was how these people were living it, how they were embodying compassion and kindness. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to it, but I wasn't ever somebody who was really wanting to be a monastic, but I was eventually, it happened. In 1970, I was ordained as the first American Tibetan Buddhist nun.
Were your parents practicing Buddhists when you were growing up?
No. My parents were Unitarian.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Love the Unitarians. I teach in a lot of their churches. So how did a Unitarian girl have that desire to want to then go to India and then follow the path that you're on? That's what intrigues me.
Well, my grandmother, I come from a very interesting family. My grandmother was the fifth woman to receive a PhD from Harvard Radcliffe, and her PhD was in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And she never expected to get married because in those days, if you took that route, then, you know, you'd be too old by the time you got finished. But she met my grandfather, who was also a PhD in philosophy from Harvard, and married him. And she was a really amazing woman, and she was interested in Buddhism and all kinds of things, abstract mathematics and all kinds of different things. And she was also a friend of Cahil Gibran.
Mm.
He drew her portrait.
Oh, my.
And so I descend really from the New England Transcendentalists.
Yes, yes.
My family. And so she gave me a book of Zen haiku brushstroke paintings called Zen Telegrams when I was 15. And I was already very attracted to Asia. I used to go, they lived in Cambridge, in Massachusetts, near Harvard. And I used to go and stay with them and wander around the square, the Harvard Square in the middle of Cambridge. And it was there that I saw for the first time a Tibetan mandala on the cover of a book, which was just published at that time. And it's called Man and His Symbols, mm-hmm. by Carl Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Tibetan mandala on the cover and then inside. And I was completely drawn into that mandala. It was as though I was looking at it, and then I entered it. I had this kind of experience in the bookstore, and then bought the book and took it home and found Tibetan mandalas in there. And so I had the opportunity, because my friend Vicky's father was the consul general in Calcutta, and she was going over there, and so I went with her, and then I was able to meet the Tibetans at that early age.
Hmm. I'm still stunned about your grandmother knowing Cahil Gibran and having him paint her portrait. Not everybody can say that. Do you remember what she said about that experience, or about knowing him, the kind of man that he was?
She found him very interesting. She liked stimulating conversation.
Yeah.
And so she had a lot of friends who were, you know, in Boston around Cambridge. They were stimulating and interesting people. And so she enjoyed his presence.
Yeah.
And I think he enjoyed hers, too.
I'm sure he did. The subtitle of your book, A Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine, you mentioned mandalas before. Let's define that. What is a mandala, and how can we use it today?
I would call a mandala, it's quite simply, a template of wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a circle with four quadrants and a center. Mandalas appear in Western culture, in the rose windows, in Sundance, and medicine wheels, and also in South America and so on. Many countries have a form of this because it's what Jung called an archetype of wholeness. And then in the Tibetan tradition took this and really developed it from India. Buddhism went to Tibet from India, and there were mandalas in India, but the extent and the elaborateness of the Tibetan mandalas is really unique to Tibet. And so in that sense, in that culture, what you do with the mandala is you place your mind in that structure. You meditate with yourself at the center of the mandala, which is also interesting because that's what the Navajo people do, and with the sand mandalas that they create, mm-hmm. they use them for healing.
Yes.
They place the sick person in the center of the sand mandala. Mm-hmm. But in any case, in the Tibetan mandala, you place your mind within the mandala, and you see your body transforming into the deity at the center of the mandala. So you're holding your mind into this state of wholeness that has symbolic meaning. So you have to know the meaning of the various directions and the colors and so on to have it be really effective. Although mandalas do arise in people in all kinds of forms of mandalas, which is what Jung talked about and discovered, that aren't prescribed in the sense of certain meanings and so on that the Tibetan mandala has.
Can you also explain, because you talk a lot about this throughout the book, what the dakinis are?
Yes, the dakinis in Tibetan, the word is kadro, which means sky goer. Hmm. They are the most important manifestation of the feminine in Tibetan Buddhism. And they are embodiments of wisdom. But they're not in the usual way that we would think of a female embodiment of wisdom, like, for example, the Virgin Mary, or a peaceful sort of seated form of the sacred feminine in terms of images of her. They're dancing, and they're naked, and they're wearing bone ornaments, and they're full of energy, and they're fierce.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
They're offering another kind of model of our sacred feminine, which embodies fierceness, action, dance, and freedom.
Do you think a lot of people have totally misunderstood what sacred feminine is all about? Because I'm thinking a lot of folk would never equate fierceness and action with sacred feminine.
Yes,
well, they would tend to equate that with the patriarchal, masculine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I think the sacred feminine is that peaceful aspect also, and that's very important, like Green Tara or the Madonna.
Yes.
That's an aspect. The fierceness of the dakinis is not aggression. It's the transformation of anger into a fast-moving energy of fierce compassion. So it if you think of it rather than as angry or wrathful, as fast-moving and powerful and compassionate wisdom.
Yes.
You have that. And I think it's important also, it was important for me to have a model of the feminine that was also sexual. Because otherwise it becomes like, oh, if you're spiritual, you're not sexual. And that split in itself is patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
That the idea, not only sexuality, but just the body itself not being sacred. So since the body is sacred, sexuality is part of it. And so this female model that includes a sacred sexuality is also important, and it's also important to understand one thing I want to point out and just define while we're here talking about this is that there's something happening in the West now called Neo-Tantra, which people associate the word Tantra with, and it's all about sex. It's basically sacred sexuality taught in various ways.
Yeah.
When I say Tantra, I mean so much more than that. And Buddhist Tantra does have that aspect, but it's mandalas, it's deity yoga, it's all of the practices, the richness of Tibetan Buddhism, some of which is monastic.
Mm.
And so that's something that I need to distinguish, because Tantric Buddhism is not Neo-Tantra.
Yeah. So when we're talking about the sacred feminine and that fierceness, it's really it's action born out of love.
Yeah. You could say that.
Yeah, like sacred activism, inner work of heart
and
with
wisdom.
Outer service in the world. Yes, and with wisdom, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. In the book, you also go into great detail about the five families of Dakina. Can you share just briefly what those are?
Sure.
Yeah.
So these are called the five Buddha families or the mm-hmm. five Dakini families.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, if we imagine ourselves again in that template of wholeness, I'll take you into the families as we go around.
Okay.
So let's start in the center with the Buddha Dakini. Here the element is space. The obstructed emotional pattern is spaciness, depression, in its extreme form, dissociation, procrastination, vagueness, confusion, bewilderment, that kind of energy. When that is transformed into its wisdom aspect, it becomes all-encompassing wisdom, which is connected to space. So spacey becomes spacious wisdom. So each of the five families has an obstructed pattern, or I call it sometimes an encumbered pattern, and traditionally it's called a poison. That very poison has in itself the seeds of wisdom.
Mm.
When the struggle of the ego is removed, that wisdom is already there. So that's in the center. That's the first family, and that's called Buddha family. So if you remember, Buddha family is white. It's the element of space, and the wisdom is all-encompassing wisdom. Then if you move forward into the east side of the mandala, which would be in front of you, when you sit in the mandala, the east is always in front of you because of the rising sun, you have the element of water.
Mm-hmm.
And the color is blue. The obstructed pattern is anger, which can be hot or cold. And it's interesting, the element is water, because it's the only element that we have that can freeze into something solid and also burn with steam. And so that's anger. We can have cold and hot anger. When that becomes wisdom, it becomes mirror-like wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The mind like a clear mirror, like a mountain lake. So that's in the east. Then in the south, which would be to your right, if you're in the mandala, that's the color of yellow. The element is earth. The obstructed pattern is pride, which has underneath it a feeling of inadequacy, of not being good enough, of there not being enough. So this pride leads to consumerism, to needing to eat more, buy more, shop, consume. That's the obstructed pattern.
Yeah.
The wisdom is the wisdom of equanimity and unchanging stillness. So you move out of the need to consume to a trust in the earth, evenness, stability, and holding that groundedness with the earth. So that's in the south. And then behind you would be the red Padma Dakini. Her element is fire. Her obstructed pattern is grasping or desire. And her wisdom is the wisdom of discernment, being able to see differences, being able to understand the relationship of objects, of sounds, visual things. And so this family rules the arts, connected to the arts. In its obstructed form, it's grasping at compulsive seduction without being able to settle into any relationship, just needing to keep magnetizing.
Hmm.
Sort of the Don Juan or the Don Juanita.
Don Juanita.
Yeah, we all do it. So that's the West. And then in the North is the green Karma Dakini. And she's connected to the color green. The element is air, and her obstructed energy, or the obstructed energy of Karma family, is jealousy, envy, speediness, workaholic tendencies, the need to keep going, keep pushing, in order to feel like you're not getting left behind.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of paranoia in Karma family, speediness. I think the whole world is getting taken over with Karma family in some ways.
I would agree.
Yeah. And then the wisdom there is wisdom of all-accomplishing wisdom,
mm-hmm.
of being in the flow rather than the force in terms of your activity.
Mm. And by the way, you have a great chart of everything you just shared and more, mm-hmm. laid out in your book on page 134. There's so many great resources in this book. I guess my next question is, how do we find out which of the five families of Dakini we fall under?
Yeah. We're about to post a quiz on that. But when you read them, there's a chapter on each of the five Dakinis. You will find yourself.
Okay.
In fact, you might find yourself in all of them.
Thank you. Because when I read this, I remembered my first social psychology class at Purdue, and I swear I had every disorder in the DSM manual. And I was reading these, and oh my gosh, I think I'm all of these.
Yeah,
but I'll do it mindfully next time.
We all have aspects.
Yes.
And, you know, the ones where you think, oh, that's not me, often that's your shadow.
Can you give us an example of how, by using an exercise from your book, you have lots of wonderful ones, that someone can actually create change in their own life?
Mm-hmm. Well, we could maybe do something together just as a little experiment,
mm-hmm.
So that the listeners could try something. Let's try working with anger.
Mm-hmm.
I think many of us are feeling that in one way or another right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we work with that? So let's take a moment and feel anger, perhaps recalling a situation that triggered you in mm-hmm. some sort of uprising of anger,
mm-hmm.
and notice how that feels in your body. Just bring a kind of mindful awareness to the feeling of anger in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And now what we'll do is use the seed syllable, which means almost like a vibrational field of energy through sound, of the Vajradakini, which is ha, the sound of ha, H-A, and the color blue, like the blue of the autumn sky, at least the autumn sky in Colorado, that deep blue color. And so we'll sound the seed syllable ha, and I'll sound it, and the listeners, if they're in a situation where they can do it, can try this, to feel the anger,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll sound the seed syllable ha, and allow the blue light and the sound to go through your body. So rather than sounding it out,
mm-hmm.
imagine the sound is going in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I'm going to sound it, and the listeners can try this if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
Start with the anger, and then allow the sound and the color blue to go through your body, and notice what happens to the anger. Ah. Can you tell me what you felt?
I felt more calmness mm-hmm. within myself. Mm-hmm. And I love between the sound and also the color blue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really helpful because I'm having a hard time watching the news now these days. So I will remember this exercise.
You'll be sounding ha a lot.
Ha, 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 ha. Which, thank you very much. Let me ask you this question. I've heard that this has happened. I'm not sure. But we're talking about inequality. And does inequality exist in Buddhism? And if so, did you personally experience any of that?
You mean in terms of gender?
Yes.
Yes, it does. Unfortunately, Buddhism is not immune to the sexism that we find in all other religions. I think it's changing, hopefully changing, but you know, there's a long way to go, mm-hmm. as there is in most situations, not only religions. I will say that my teachers were really amazing with me. I never felt I wasn't getting the full teachings because of being a woman. But when it really hit me was I went to a series of empowerments. Empowerments are when certain practices are transmitted. And this was a big collection of them. Mm-hmm. And it was going to go for 3 months. And so it was in a big temple. And when I went, I was told I had to sit in the back behind even the very youngest monks, who were mostly not interested in being monks. They were like 5 or 6 years old, and they were playing and really distracted. And so I had to sit there because I was a nun, female, and that this was the rule, that no matter how long, I mean, I was quite young and not terribly distinguished as a nun at that time, but had I even been a very old and wise nun, I would have had to sit behind those young monks because of being a woman.
And how did that make you feel at that time?
I was shocked, honestly, because mm-hmm. I hadn't experienced this with my teachers. Mm-hmm. And then I found out it was actually, they say that it's what the Buddha taught.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's what he actually taught or if it what it's what the sort of misogynist monks later said that he said, you know. we will never know.
Yeah.
But according to sort of Buddhist history, the Buddha did refuse to ordain women twice. Mm-hmm. And then finally his cousin Ananda intervened and said, well, don't women have Buddha nature? And he said, yes, they do.
So early on, you were practicing ha and the color blue a lot.
You know, honestly, it wasn't that prevalent for me.
Yeah,
but when I started to research for my first book, Women of Wisdom, mm-hmm. and I really started to look into this, and then at that time also nuns were trying to get the full ordination, which they had lost, I became more and more aware of it. And then, you know, saw how women were treated within Buddhism. And
yes.
Unfortunately, it's true, and I wish the Dalai Lama would be talking about that more. He's had a lot of meetings with scientists for many years, but he hasn't had meetings about this, although he has said that he will possibly come back as a woman and that he learned compassion from his mother.
So the book is Wisdom Rising, and the information in this book, it helps the reader to become empowered. You refer to it as the return of the sacred feminine. What do you mean by that?
Well, I talk about, in the title of the book is Empowered, mm-hmm. But I really have been thinking about the word empowered, I-N, empowered.
Yeah.
That my book, in a way, it starts with that very wide lens in the introduction about the situation in the world today and this parallel connection of women and nature and so on and those statistics. And then it moves into my story, my personal story of going to India and so on, meeting the mandala and then the five Buddha families. And that sort of narrows down in the end into these practices, into these meditation practices. And to me, that's the journey, that we start outside with outer empowerment, but at some point we need to get that inner empowerment through meditation in order to be the change that we want to see.
Mm-hmm. So meditation,
inner transfer. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, meditation then is key.
Yes, because that's the inner shift. If we don't shift inwardly, how are we going to shift the outer world?
Yes. Yes. I've been on the website that you have, ataramandala.org, and very, very intrigued by everything I was reading there. Can you share more about your retreat center? And
yeah.
Is anyone welcome there to visit?
Yes, anyone's welcome. So Tara Mandala, I founded with my husband who passed away in 2010. Very sad and very shocking situation. But we founded it in 1994, mm-hmm. and it's 700 acres of land in southwest Colorado. You fly into Durango. It's about an hour from Durango,
yeah,
Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So close to the New Mexico border. And we have retreats. We have group retreats. We're starting our season now. We do them mostly in the summer and sort of spring, summer, and fall. And then the whole community, there's a community of about 25 people who live there year-round. And then we kind of go into more retreat ourselves in the winter, and then we kind of come out as the green grass comes up. We come out also. And so we have group retreats. We have a beautiful, really extraordinarily beautiful, and I think you got a sense of it probably from the website, temple,
yes,
dedicated to the sacred feminine in Buddhism with mm-hmm. life-size stories of the 21 Taras and a library of Tibetan and English books and so on in this three-story mandalic temple that was created by Tibetan and Buddhist artisans. So it's really an amazingly beautiful place to be. We have rainbows, we have lots of wild animals and eagles and so on. And then we also have hermitage cabins that you can go into for a few days or a longer time if you have longer time. And so that's sort of our activities. But Tara Mandala is also an international web of centers. And so we have groups all over the world, particularly in the United States and Europe, but also in South Africa and other places, Bhutan and so on. And so we have this retreat center where you can come. There's a very comfortable building, resident building where you can stay. And then we also have the cabins and then sort of the greater web of meditation and practice centers that people can connect with. If they're looking for a group, they can see if there's one in their area.
Yes.
Or also we have online programs, and I'm also starting to do more webcasting and teaching online. We just got really good internet, mm-hmm. finally came out of the dark ages. And so if people can't come to Tara Mandala, they can watch my Lama Soltra Malione Facebook page and our web page for online teachings and transmissions. So that's some options.
Well, I absolutely feel called to visit your retreat center.
So that would be great.
I look forward to being out there here sometime soon. Sorry to hear about the loss of your husband.
Thank you.
Grateful for this beautiful new book you have penned for humanity. And thank you once again for sharing your light in this world and for gracing us with your presence here on the radio show.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure. You asked really good questions, and I can feel, I haven't been aware of your program before, but I can feel it's really beneficial. So thank you for your work.
Once again, to learn more about this great book and more about the work of Lama Sultran Aliona, please visit taramandala.org. And now, before we get to my interview that I did with Neil Donald Walsh, it was actually the first conversation I had with him many years ago. It was about his book, New Revelations. Let's have our newest Mary Grace Pinella Wellness Minute.
Calcium is your friend. Did you know that for your muscles to work, you need both calcium and magnesium? Further, when you ask your body to work or just move, if it doesn't have the needed calcium and magnesium, it will steal them from wherever it can. And to relax those muscles, you also need calcium and magnesium. They need to be readily available and in the correct ratio. That's why you can work all day and not necessarily feel muscle soreness, but when you lie down to sleep, your muscles let you know by being itchy, twitchy, achy, or sore on waking. Chances are good that you have not provided a ready supply of your friend calcium or its buddy magnesium. So where do you get these minerals? Almonds, oranges, broccoli, and okra are good sources of calcium, and spinach, avocado, and dark chocolate are excellent sources of magnesium. Food is always your first choice for vitamins and minerals. The next best way to get your minerals needs met is through whole food supplements. Whole food supplements help your body work more efficiently. For more information about your health and nutrition, visit our website, drpinella.com.
My guest today is Neil Donald Walsh, who's a modern-day spiritual messenger whose words continue to touch the world in profound ways. He's the author of the best-selling series Conversations with God, and he has a new book out now called New Revelations, which offers a timely and provocative perspective on the current global crisis and provides essential advice on how we can not only avoid despair, but help to repair the world. He joins us from New York City. Neil Donald Walsh, welcome to Journey's Fire.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
There are a lot of questions, Neil, facing our world today, and it seems that New Revelations provides answers to those questions, although they're not easy answers, are they? They cause people to stretch.
Yes, I do, if those people have been caught up in old beliefs about God and about life, beliefs that are hundreds or in some cases thousands of years old, which have had, over those thousands of years, a minimum degree, if any degree, of flexibility. If you've been caught in an inflexible belief system, then I think that the new revelations would be challenging and would be difficult, but not impossible to embrace. I do hope, though, that people will ultimately embrace them, not as the answer to all the problems besetting humankind today, but as a possible beginning of a new dialogue and the basis for the formation of a new spirituality on the earth, because the current construction of our theologies is leading us, I think, into a place of great despair and self-destruction.
Yeah, New Revelation says that organized religion is a serious problem. Why don't you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, we're facing a crisis right now in the world today. No one can deny that. You just look at the headlines and see what's going on in the world, and we are really moving headlong, racing headlong toward our own self-destruction. There's no question about that. And if we're not careful, we're going to get exactly where we're going. And the difficulty that we now have is that the human race is seeking to resolve this crisis. By the way, it's not that we're not trying to solve it. We are. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to solve it by means that have nothing to do with the problem itself, which is why the problem never does get solved. What I'm trying to say is that we are approaching the crisis at a level at which the crisis does not exist. We're using political means, economic means, even military means to solve a problem which is not a political, economic, or military problem. It's a spiritual crisis, and that is something that either most people don't understand or they are simply unwilling to admit. Perhaps the latter, because they do not know how to solve it. Spiritual problems challenge humanity at the highest level and cause us, in fact, to at least question, if not change, our most basic and our most sacred beliefs. And we don't like to do that as human beings. We will move forward in our medical sciences. We'll move forward in our political and social sciences. We will race forward in our technological sciences. But we want to stand absolutely still where we were a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand years ago in our theological sciences, if you please. We don't want our theologies to change, and we don't want to question our most basic fundamental beliefs, because to do so would be to make ourselves, or our elders, those who have given us these beliefs, to make ourselves wrong, and we don't want to, we're loath to do that. So we hang on to our to our fundamental sacred beliefs, even though everything else in our human experience is racing forward into the 21st century, our religions stay right where they were thousands of years ago. It would be very much as if we were operating in the operating room with unsterilized instruments, or trying to send a rocket to the moon with a single stick of dynamite. We've just not made enough progress there. And so because we have been afraid to step out and to seriously consider a new spiritual idea, at least organized religion has not done so in many, many, many years. Because that's been true, we're in a place called stuck. And that wouldn't be bad if it just meant we weren't making a lot of progress, but it's worse than that. It's actually stopping us from moving forward now with our lives, because it's like placing matches in the hands of children. We do have a technology. We do have a medical science. We do have social and political phenomena that have raced forward, and we're trying to negotiate all of those advances with a morality that hasn't had, as I said, a new thought in a very long time. We have not challenged our God in a very long time. So that's the nature of the crisis. It's a crisis of belief. And what we're seeing right now, all around the world, all you have to do is just look up and look around you, and you'll see this, is not a war between nations so much. That's war between cultures, and that is a war between beliefs. People are attacking each other right and left on this planet right now, and they're doing so not because of something that lies deep within the heart of human beings, but because something that has been placed deep within the mind of human beings by exclusivist, punitive, organized religion.
One thing you say repeatedly in different ways throughout the book is all behaviors are the result of beliefs, which is why it's so important to challenge the beliefs that we've had, which are causing events that aren't working for us.
That is correct. There is not a single behavior that is not sponsored by a belief behind it. And what we've been trying to do for the past several thousand years is alter human behavior at the level of behavior. That is, we've been trying to change things through what we would call behavior mod, behavior modification. And the most brutal form of behavior modification is, I have a bigger stick than you do, and I'm going to hit you with my stick if you don't stop hitting me with yours. and so we drop bombs, or we apply economic pressure or political pressure or all three on each other in an attempt to change behaviors, rather than doing what is the painfully obvious thing to do, which is to direct our attention to the beliefs that sponsor the behaviors that we would seek to change. But no one seriously does that, because beliefs are sacred cows. We don't want to touch our belief systems. We would rather hang on to our belief systems even when they're not working, even when they're killing us.
Now, here in the United States, we're waiting perhaps any day to hear word of what we're going to be doing with Iraq. Has a lot to also do with politics, and you say that politics is spirituality demonstrated. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the words speak for themselves. Politics is the demonstration of our highest spiritual thoughts. Economics is a demonstration of our spirituality. Everything that we do in life, in fact, demonstrates what we believe about God and about ourselves, about each other, and about life itself. So in truth, there is no part of life that is not an aspect of or a demonstration of our spirituality. And politics is that profoundly. If politics is not a demonstration of our beliefs, then what is it? And beliefs is just another word for spirituality. It's what we think about God and about life. Even if our thoughts about God are that there is no God, that still is our thought about God. That's our spirituality. And so politics is a demonstration of our spirituality. If we would look at it that way and just announce it and get it over with, which I have to give credit, there are some countries that actually do that. But we have a tradition here of pretending to separate church and state. But separation of church and state is not the same as separating politics and spirituality, because a church is not the same as spirituality. Religion, or a church, is an organization that tells us what to believe. Spirituality, on the other hand, is a deep inner personal experience that allows us to construct our own awareness and come to clarity about our own highest truth. And so spirituality, that is, our own highest truth, should never be separated from politics. But religion, that is an organization that has a particular point of view, definitely should be separated from politics. So separation from church and state makes complete sense and always has in the United States. But separation of politics and spirituality is not the same thing at all. We are asking that our highest thoughts about life and how it is, our highest thoughts about human beings and how we relate to each other and our highest thoughts about God, whatever those thoughts might be the basis of all of our political actions. If that were to happen, the world would change overnight.
Neil, in your book, you also talk about 10 fallacies that are causing our belief system to create behaviors that don't work, 5 fallacies about God and 5 fallacies about life. I know we don't have time to get into all 10 right now. Your book does a very good job of that. But what can you say to speak to those fallacies that you lay out in the book?
Well, I think they're profound statements of enormous errors that human beings have made and are continuing to make, and that I've made all of my life. And all of us have, mm-hmm. As we come to our understandings about God and about life. And they drive the engine of our experience. I'll just use one of the 10. You're right, we don't have time for 10, but the most important one is the very first one. We have an idea that God somehow needs something from us. And so the first fallacy is that God needs something from human beings in order to be happy. And as long as we imagine that, we will imagine that God is either angry or not angry, either pleased or displeased with us, depending upon whether we meet God's needs. Of course, there are 1,000 different viewpoints on how to meet God's needs. There is the Islamic viewpoint, there's the Christian viewpoint, there's the Jewish viewpoint, there's the Mormon viewpoint, and the Hindu viewpoint, and so on and so forth. And so it's kind of like pick a card, any card. But if you pick the wrong card, it's like Russian roulette. You go straight to hell. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Proceed straight to hell. And so we need to be real clear that the God of this universe has no needs. That is one of the 9 new revelations, that God is not a super being living somewhere inside the universe or outside of it, subject to the same emotional turmoils and having the same emotional needs as human beings, that God needs nothing and requires nothing in order to be happy, that God is happiness itself, and therefore, by definition, requires nothing of anyone or anything in the universe. Once we can get off of this, once we can step away from this idea that we have to somehow perform certain rituals or act in a certain way in order to keep God happy, then we can suddenly begin to step away also from our own righteousness with regard to how to do that. The idea that God needs something is a primitive idea. It came to us in the early and most primitive days of human beings, has been captured in the mythologies of those early days and been passed on to us in the form of the doctrines in organized religion. In the earliest days, we didn't understand why we had earthquakes or the sun baked us for 40 days straight, or we didn't have no rain, or conversely, it rained for 40 days and we had floods everywhere. We didn't understand why the world was the way it was, especially nature. We presumed that these outcomes of nature were the results of the anger of the gods, and so we made sacrifices to the gods in order to placate the gods. We even burned our own children on pyres of fire. Later, we burned animals instead. We had these terrible sacrifices in order to appease gods who we imagined required appeasement. And religion is nothing more than a modern version of God appeasement. How can we appease an angry deity and please God by performing these rituals in this way, bowing to the east or making the sign of the cross or failing to eat pork or whatever it is we imagine that we have to do, that God is going to be upset about if we don't do that? Mm-hmm. And so religion turns out to be our attempt to appease an otherwise angry God and to mollify him. I'm suggesting in the new revelations, and God is suggesting through me, that you've got God all wrong. We don't have to appease anybody, therefore we don't have to fight with each other over the best way to do that.
And so you write in your book that the 5 fallacies about God and the 5 fallacies about life create crisis, violence, killing, and war.
Well, sure, because we think that our survival's at stake. You know, if you think your survival's at stake, you're going to fight everyone around you who's not doing it your way, because we all want to survive. It's the survival instinct kicking in at the highest level. If we think that the guy next to us is offending the creator of the universe, we're going to say, hey, stop that. Cut it out. And if he won't cut it out, we're going to kill him. That's how the Christian Crusades went on for 200 years and caused, apparently and declaredly so, God-loving people to go out and kill hundreds of thousands of people. It's what causes people to fly airplanes into buildings in New York City. It's what causes apparently God-loving people and turns them into God-fearing people and causes them to kill each other because our survival instinct kicks in. Now, what happens if we adopt the idea that God doesn't need or want us to do anything? of those of that nature in order to appease him, that mollifying God is not required. Then we'll stop being angry with each other because we imagine that one or the other of us is doing it wrong and ruining it for the entire human race.
Laid out in your book, the New Revelations are also 9 new revelations that God has given us through you. Let's speak about the 8th new revelation, which says, "You're not your body. Who you are is limitless and without end." What kind of change could happen within the individual if they could embrace that belief?
Well, our whole value system would be turned upside down. And we wouldn't even be concerned with mollifying or not mollifying God, and nor would we be concerned with having the things that concern us now.
And before we close, here's a word from all of our sponsors, which we are very grateful for.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
And that is today's program. I want to thank my special guest, Lama Sultram Aliona, for being on today's program. And our website is richardbrendan.org. A reminder that all shows are podcast on that site. And so for engineer Aaron Duvall and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.